There we go. I don't have the title on the screen anymore. All right. Yeah, it's on the sheet. I got it. We're ready. Okay, welcome back, everybody. This is class number 4. We're doing good. Class 4, this is the Simi Hills Ecclesial Study Day 2014. We have our brother Alan Laban with us. We're doing James, the testing of our faith. And this is class 4 with faith tested through speech, James 2 and 3. Brother Alan.
All right, hello again. All right, so we're going to wrap up the rest of the consideration of the second test of faith found in James 2, which was part of our third class, before we go into the third test of faith, which is in James chapter 3 for the rest of our fourth class. Get that all straight? All right. So we left off with a cliffhanger, right? We have this apparent contradiction in James chapter 2 between the words of James and the words of Paul. One seems to say that Abraham was justified by works. The other seems to say that Abraham was not justified by works. And so we're going to use the three C's of Bible study. Does anybody happen to know what those three C's of Bible study might be?
Context.
Got one. It's good.
Cross-references.
Jeff, help him out. There you go. What a little biblical common sense. All right. Well, that's the first one. So good start. All right. So the first clue to unlocking this is given in the context of both of those verses. In Romans chapter 4, verse 2, and we're going to bounce back and forth these two places. So let's start off over in Romans, but keep a hand in James if you like. In Romans chapter 4, verse 2, when Paul is talking about works, he's not just talking about any works. If you look at the context of Romans 4, verse 2, and you go back to Romans chapter 3, verse 28, he is specifically talking about works associated with the law of Moses. The context also gives us another clue for reconciling these two passages. We know in James, the context is that Abraham was about to sacrifice Isaac, right? That's the specific example of faith that James looks at. He could have looked at other examples, but that's the one he's bringing up. An event that took place when Abraham was an old man toward the end of his life. But in Romans, Paul leads the reader's mind toward the beginning of Abraham's service to God and his initial belief in the promises. Look at the context of Romans chapter 4, verses 16 through 22. While James was speaking about the end of Abraham's walk, Paul was talking about the beginning of Abraham's walk. Thus, James and Paul, though they spoke of the same man, focused on different aspects of his life and different aspects of his faith. James concerned himself with how Abraham's faith was made perfect or made mature, complete, and whole, and how it grew, the way it was perfected through works. Whereas Paul talked about Abraham early in his walk, just as he was receiving the promises and that his seed would be multiplied and blessed. At that very early point, Abraham had a budding faith that had just begun with few associated works. Paul was talking about Abraham early in his walk. Paul describes the start of the process. James sees it to its conclusions. Abraham's justification started through faith, but it was completed and seen and made evident through the maturing of that faith as it produced works. In addition, the context of the two authors, of the folks to whom Paul was writing, the folks to whom James was writing, was different as well. James, as we know, wrote to a very Jewish ecclesia. Paul, on the other hand, wrote to the Greeks in Romans. James wrote to the Jews who were freed from the law and called to freedom. And he had to remind those folks that, yes, you're freed from the law, but you're still supposed to do works of faith. On the other hand, Paul wrote to the Romans over a decade later, and the pendulum had swung back in the other direction. It had swung one way in James's day, and James had to rein them back in. It swung the other way in Paul's day, and Paul had to rein them back in as well. James needed to emphasize works. Paul needed to emphasize faith. James and Paul were speaking about different sides of the same coin and came to the exact same conclusion. We can also see this through cross-references as well. If you consider cross-references for both passages, you'll see in no way was Paul contradicting what James was teaching. In no way was Paul teaching faith only. For example, one cross-reference from Romans 4 is over to Romans chapter 6. Chapter 6, verses 1 and 2. Paul anticipated someone misinterpreting what he wrote as a faith-only message. And look what he says in Romans 6, 1 and 2. What shall we say then? Shall we continue in sin that grace may abound? God forbid. Paul flatly, very clearly says that he is not preaching a faith-alone argument, that works do matter. We're not supposed to continue in sin. Our works, what we do, matters. As we know, Paul in Romans 6 then goes on to speak of baptism, the first work or act of obedience, one that is motivated by faith. And I think one of the best phrases around faith and works comes from Paul. Look over in Galatians chapter 5 and verse 6. Paul is probably the one who can be attributed with the phrase that most tightly ties together these concepts of faith and works. Galatians chapter 5, verses 5 and 6. For we through the Spirit wait for the hope of righteousness by faith. For in Jesus Christ neither circumcision availeth anything nor uncircumcision, but faith which worketh by love. From the use of cross-references, it's clear that both James and Paul understood the synergy, as James put it, between faith and works, and the fact that faith does works, it worketh by love, as Paul says over in Galatians chapter 5. And then finally, you can use some good old biblical common sense and reconcile the two passages as well. Brother Neville Smart, in his commentary on James, wrote that if we were to take the stance that Paul was in opposition to James, then in the same way he would be in opposition to John the Baptist in Matthew 3, to Jesus in Matthew 7 and 8, and ultimately between the Paul of Romans chapter 4 and the Paul of Romans chapter 6 and the Paul of Galatians chapter 2 and 3. Just a little biblical common sense can certainly show that Paul was not trying to make a faith alone argument. James and Paul spoke in total harmony as they addressed different audiences at different times and had to emphasize different aspects of common stories. Despite the apparent contradiction, James and Paul were united in their teachings in regards to the need for a living and active faith, a faith that's not just a collection of facts or beliefs, but that is shown in the way you live. All right, and that's going to bring us into our last section with these final two examples. We saw the example of Abraham, and now to the example of Rahab. In verse 25, we next meet Rahab, the harlot of Jericho, who hid the spies from Israel as they entered the land under Joshua. So we read the following in verse 25. Likewise also, was not Rahab the harlot justified by works when she received the messengers and sent them out another way? It's very telling that he brings up this up to his audience of Jewish brethren. Here, there was a woman who knew nothing of the law that was justified by works. James is making the point that it was not the works of the law that are justified. The works of Rahab could not have been works of the law at all. She didn't even know the law at the time. It's pretty clear what her good works were. But where was her faith? Where was the faith of Rahab? We see her works were welcoming the messengers or receiving the messengers, but what's the evidence of her faith? The answer is hidden in James' word choice. Compare what we read here in James verse 25 with how it's spoken about in Hebrews chapter 11 and verse 31. Let's look over in Hebrews chapter 11, verse 31. Hebrews 11, 31. By faith the harlot Rahab perished not with them that believed not when she received the spies with peace. Did you notice the difference between the two passages? They're talking about the same works, but there is a different word choice used in Hebrews versus James. Hebrews 11 said that Rahab hid the spies. What does it call them in James chapter 2, verse 25? In James, it says messengers, right? In James, it says that Rahab received them as messengers. When she saw them, knowing what she knew about God, she saw them as messengers to herself. And at great personal risk, she received them into her house. What an exhortation to the ecclesia to who James wrote, where the naked and destitute brethren are being turned away by brethren. Here we have a Gentile harlot was willing to take them in and see these spies coming to her in need as messengers from God. That was her faith. So why were these two examples Rahab and Abraham selected. Because between these two examples of Abraham and Rahab lie the stories of everyone who has ever come into the truth. We have one man and one woman. We have one who was a good person, another who was a bad person. We have one from the line of the faithful, another from the outside, who was completely new to the truth. We move from the Hebrew Abraham to the Gentile Rahab, from an old man at the end of his walk to a young woman at the very start of hers. One had an act of obedience in response to a specific command from God, go sacrifice Isaac, whereas the other had a work, which was a spontaneous act of faith in connection with a divine event. James could not have selected two more different individuals in order to make his point. And he was trying to make a very specific point. And the point was, no matter how old or young we are, however newly baptized or experienced we are in the truth, no matter our natural inclinations, there aren't some of us that are excused for having faith with no works and others that can have works with no faith. We all need both. John, who heavily pulled on the writings of James, makes the same point in his first letter. We don't really have time to take a look there now, but a couple of key passages are over in 1 John chapter 2, verse 4 and 5, and chapter 3, verses 16 through 19. So we're going to actually come and conclude our study of James chapter 2 with the last verse. So we've alluded to it a couple of times. James chapter 2 ends with this. He repeats his point a third time. We've heard it twice already. And once again, whereas the body without the spirit is dead, so faith without works is dead also. Why does James use this illustration that faith is dead without works? The final verse answers it by setting up a parallelism. It's because he's trying to show us that our faith is what that our works is what makes our faith come alive. Reread verse 26 and pay attention to with what words James is contrasting. So this is a parallelism, right? We see him a lot in Psalms, same idea, stated twice, see it a lot in Proverbs. And there's a parallel between the first and second statement. For as the body without the spirit is dead, body is paralleled with faith, and spirit is paralleled with works. What's connected with the body is faith. What's connected with the spirit that makes the body alive? It's works. And you'd almost expect it to be the other way around. You'd almost expect that the body would be represented by works, the things that we do with our hands, and that faith would be represented by the animating spirit. But under inspiration, James says that the works are our spirit, that they are what makes our faith come alive. The body of faith comes alive through works. God is not the God of the dead, but of the living. Our God is not a God who finds pleasure in a dead faith that has no action associated with it, but one who wants to see our faith not as something purely intellectual, but as associated with things that happen, things are being done. God doesn't want our faith to be something purely intellectual, but something that transforms our characters and the way we live. That brings us through the end of James chapter 2, and to our third test of faith. All right. Faith tested through speech. All right. So we will begin this class, as we have begun others, with a Wordle to help emphasize what the main point of this chapter is. You have a copy of this one as well in your handout on page 7, and it comes out pretty clearly. When we get to James chapter 3, this chapter is about the tongue. And in this chapter, we're going to talk about one of the most difficult things to do in the world. Controlling what we say and how we speak is incredibly challenging. And James is going to make that point. It is something also that, in addition to creating great evil, can also create great good. Some of the best things we can do in our lives and some of the worst things we can do in our lives all have to do with what we say. So having spoken about in James chapter 2 about how faith is seen in our works, in chapter 3, he focuses on one of the most challenging works to manifest, controlling the tongue and using it for good rather than evil. So in this class, we are going to see James use 6 examples to illustrate various powers of the tongue. The power of the tongue to direct, to destroy, and to delight. James will then close this chapter by considering the underlying key to pass the 3 tests of faith that we have discussed so far today. Here in chapter 3, we'll also read some of the most challenging material in this book. and we will also see some of the most practical advice so far. So let's dive in with verse 1. James chapter 3, verse 1. My brethren, be not many masters or teachers, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. This is always a verse that's very nervous, kind of nerve-wracking to read when you're the one talking at the time. So it's quite relevant in terms of its message. It makes sense, though, doesn't it? That James will begin his consideration of the tongue by talking about those who use their tongues quite a bit, someone who's in a role of a teacher. If you're in the role of a teacher, you're going to be using your tongue a good bit, and it makes sense that James is going to warn teachers of its impact. By saying, be not many teachers, though, James is in no way trying to discourage us from teaching and preaching the things of the truth. To some extent, we're all called to be teachers, inasmuch we're supposed to speak about the things that we know to be true in the gospel. The Great Commission of Mark chapter 16, verse 15, is one that applies to all of us. Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature. That applies to every single one of us. Paul also writes, preach the word, be instant in season, out of season. When it comes to teaching in the form of preaching the truth, it's a responsibility we all have, and James is in no way trying to discourage that task. Instead, what James is trying to do here is he's trying to warn those in positions of leadership in the ecclesia. James is trying to address a double-minded motive that we know was present in some, an issue that also had deep roots in the Jewish community. Recall for a moment the words of Jesus when he confronted the Pharisees and the Sadducees back in Matthew chapter 23, verses 5 through 7. Matthew 23 and 5 through 7. But all their works they do to be seen of men. They make broad their phylacteries and enlarge the borders of their garments, and they love the uppermost rooms at the feast and the chief seats in the synagogues, the greetings in the markets, and to be called of men, Rabbi, Rabbi. And note back of verse 1 of Matthew chapter 23, that it says here, Jesus was speaking unto his followers, to his disciples. He was warning them against the desire for preeminence. Jesus was telling his disciples, the next verse, that they should not chase after being called rabbi or being called teachers. Be ye not called rabbi, in verse 8, for one is your master, even Christ, and ye are all brethren. James, in chapter 3, verse 1, is pulling on the words of Jesus from Matthew chapter 23. He is repeating the warning. We all have an obligation to speak the things we know to be true, but we also must recognize there can be a force of human pride whenever we think that we have something that someone else doesn't. When we think we have a kernel of truth that someone else doesn't have, there can be pride that slips into the equation when we think we understand something than everyone else. And when that's combined with the ability to speak or instruct particularly well, you have the recipe for a mixed motive. On one hand, there's the good, earnest desire to teach the things the truth, but on the other hand, there's a fleshly enjoyment of having the spotlight and people's attention or admiration. And that's where the conflict arises that James is hitting at, when our desire to teach outpaces our desire to teach the truth. And unfortunately, as we see in Paul's later letters, not everyone heeded this warning. In 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, we read later that there were some that put the desire to teach ahead of the desire to teach the truth. 1 Timothy chapter 1, verses 6 and 7, some having swerved and turned aside unto vain jangling, desired to be teachers of the law, understanding neither what they said nor whereof they affirm. And so what does James mean here by a greater condemnation or a greater judgment? It seems again to be an echo of the words of Christ. Think back to Matthew chapter 18 and verse 6. When Jesus told his followers, whoso shall cause one of these little ones which believe on me to stumble, it would be better for him that a millstone were hanged about his neck and he were drowned in the depths of the sea. One in the position of a teacher would not only be judged based on their own actions, but also based on the influence they exerted over others. So with all of that on the line and such a strict warning, a very natural thought is, well, why risk it? Why shouldn't we just play it safe? Why even be a teacher at all? It seems a lot easier to remain silent and avoid all this greater condemnation than to risk it and speak up. Well, James anticipates that reaction, doesn't he? He says over in James chapter 4, verse 17, therefore him that knoweth to do good and doeth it not, to him it is sin. Inaction can be as bad as the wrong action. The solution is not to do nothing. As Jesus said in Luke chapter 12, verse 48, for unto whomsoever much is given, much shall be required. So, brethren, these are words to take to heart. And James even applies it to himself. This is the first time he uses he includes himself, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. He knows that this danger applied to him as much as it did to his hearers. He starts with the tongues of those who teach because they have an enormous impact. Not just speaking, but speaking the truth and love, as Paul says in Ephesians, must always be the emphasis. This speaks to the seriousness with which we all need to approach our Bible study, the wisdom we need to use in our expositions and explanations, the balance that we must have between mercy and truth in our classes. This also speaks to the benefit of things like mutual improvement classes. We've recently started these back up in the Baltimore and Washington Ecclesias, and it has been really, really helpful. Preaching workshops, another great example of how we can bring kind of this seriousness to our teaching and instruction. There are things that we can do as brothers and sisters and young people to learn to speak the truth in love. And there's a lot more we can say on the subject, but we're only in verse 1, so we, like James, should move on. All right, James chapter 3 and verse 2. So, like in chapter 1, James launches chapter 3 with a very bold statement. So back in James chapter 1, he talked about having joy in trials. We see his audacity continue in James chapter 3, verse 2. He says in James 3, 2, for in many things we offend in all. If any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, able also to bridle the whole body. That word offend simply means to stumble or fall. James is saying that if we can keep ourselves from stumbling in what we say, then we can be perfect. We can reach that pinnacle of spiritual maturity. And the question is, can it really be that simple? James says yes. Here, James is alluding to the teaching of his elder brother, as recorded for us in Matthew 12, a place that James will pull on frequently as he discusses the tongue. So let's go back to James's source material here in Matthew chapter 12, verses 33 through 37. Matthew 12, starting in verse 33. Either make the tree good and his fruit good, or else make the tree corrupt and his fruit corrupt. For the tree is known by his fruit. O generations of vipers, how can ye, being evil, speak good things? For out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. A good man out of the good treasures of his heart bringeth forth good things. An evil man out of the evil treasure brings forth evil things. But I say unto you, that every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account for in the day of judgment. For by thy words thou shalt be justified, and by thy words thou shalt be condemned. And so I'm sure you picked up on several different images or phrases here that James took from Jesus. But I want you to pay particular attention to what James says about where our words come from. In verse 34, Jesus said, out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaketh. Our words are a reflection of our hearts. They're a reflection of our thinking. Thus, if we are able to control or bridle our tongue, then that means we must have controlled or bridled our mind and our thinking as well. So, if we are able to take the advice of James and bridle our speech, it will have a transformative effect on every part of our walk toward the kingdom. And so James presents to us this challenge. In order to be perfect in faith, we must pass the test of the tongue. And we're presented here with three different images. We have two images of the tongue's power to direct, two images of the tongue's power to destroy, and two images of the tongue's power to delight. So let's move right into the second part, the power to direct. First, we're introduced to the image of the horse in James 3, verse 3. Behold, we put bits in the horse's mouth that they may obey us, and we turn about their whole body. James is describing these tests through a series of natural analogies. The comparison we see first is between the tongue and a bit that's placed in the horse's mouth. And the aspect of this bit that is emphasized is its ability to control or direct the whole body. It's an illustration of the same point that James made in verse 2, that our tongue has the power to direct the way which we go in life. We can be headed down in one direction, but as a result of what we say, we can pull up on the reins and completely redirect our lives down a different path. The imagery here of a horse in the Bible is also often associated with strength or power. So, for example, if you look back in Job, and I'll read these passages, you don't have to turn it up right now, but the image of a horse is often one that is associated with strength. Actually, for the sake of the time, I won't read it, but you can see that the primary aspect of a horse in Job is strength, and it's trying to show that in spite of that animal's great strength, that small little bit in its mouth can completely control its course and redirect it. Words, as we know, can make a huge difference. As a suggested study, look at all the times in scriptures where a few words completely redirected the course of events and turned things totally around. Think back to those lying words of the serpent in the garden to Eve. "You shall not surely die," led to their expulsion from the garden. Moses and his few brash words when pulling water from the rock reversed his own path toward the promised land. The first two examples are of a negative sort, but also a word can turn us completely around from a wrong direction and go back into a right direction. As it says in Proverbs chapter 15, verse 23, "A word spoken in due season, how sweet or how good it is." Consider David and Abigail. Both of their words worked tremendous good. The war horse of David, with all of his strength, was barreling down toward Nabal's house until those sweet, timely words of Abigail worked as a bit in his mouth and turned him right around. And David, whose tongue could have lashed out at her, turned his own course around, and his response to Abigail was blessing as well. So note that in this first example of the horse and the bridle, there's no value judgment passed on the tongue. A bridle is not inherently good or evil, and a horse isn't inherently good or evil either. And neither is the tongue. The tongue is not inherently good or evil. It all comes down to how we use it. The point James is making in verse 3 is that the tongue is powerful, and it can redirect our lives. And so we must use it well. Likewise, in the next verse, James makes another natural analogy, but includes no value judgment. He's not saying the tongue is either good nor evil here, but he's trying to illustrate another characteristic. "Behold," he says in verse 4, "also the ships, which though they be so great, are driven of fierce winds, yet they are turned about by a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth." The comparison here is between the tongue and a rudder on the ship. And the aspect of the ship that is emphasized is the relative size of the rudder to the rest of the ship. Even though fierce winds cannot redirect the ship, that very small rudder, that single plank in a ship made out of so many different planks, can turn around the course of that entire ship and redirect all the inhabitants that are on board. The emphasis here isn't so much on the strength of the tongue, but on the disproportionate impact one member can have on the direction of many. A ship can be made up of many thousands of planks of wood, but one plank in particular, that rudder attached to the stern of the ship, will determine the direction of all of the others. Though strong winds of outside influence might come, the ship can resist their force, but the slight inclination of that rudder from the inside can turn the vessel right around. This is an illustration of the point James was making back in verse 1. Our tongues can have a great impact on the lives of others. When we think of the works of faith that James spoke about back in chapter 2, some of the most impacting, far-reaching works that we can have will be in what we say. Like the first example, James passes no value judgment here on the tongue in verse 4. Instead, he's trying to show how influential our speech can be upon others. Like the bit can control a horse of great strength for evil or good purposes, our rudder can control that ship for better or for worse as well. Our speech is powerful no matter how it is used. We are to make the choice to use it for good. And there are plenty of Bible examples of this, where a few choice words can change the course of an entire nation. Think of King Rehoboam, right? Solomon's son, who saw the united kingdom of Israel shatter underneath his reign with a few poorly chosen words. He ripped the kingdom apart in the way that, and back in 1 Kings chapter 12, verse 14, "My father made your yoke heavy, and I will add to your yoke. My father chastised you with whips, but I will chastise you with scorpions. The nation had never been has never been mended since. But on the flip side, also think about those how those few timely words of Queen Esther and her counsel to the king of Persia changed the course of history and turned what could have been a massacre into a day of Jewish deliverance. If that is how powerful the tongue is 1,000 years ago, think of how much more powerful the tongue can be today. So back in James's day, if you said brash, hurtful, horrible things, your words would travel, and you could talk to a number of folks, but you know what, the maximum capacity of a gathering place in James's day would probably be a Roman amphitheater with seating for about 20,000. So let's go to the furthest extreme and say you could say some brash, hurtful things, and your words would negatively impact 20,000 people. Now, today, with the internet, our words can go unfathomable distances and be heard by myriads of people. And they aren't fleeting. Once something is online, it's permanent. So what do you think James would have had to say today about email, social media, posts on Facebook, Twitter, YouTube, or LinkedIn? We need to watch our words. In the world we live in today, a few choice words can impact a whole lot of planks that make up that ship. As Jesus said back in Matthew chapter 12, verse 36, every idle word that men shall speak, they shall give account thereof in the day of judgment. And so James summarizes his main point back in verse 5. Even so, the tongue is a little member. It boasteth such great things. That word boasteth in James chapter 3 and verse 5 is the Greek word megaluchio, mega meaning large, and achio meaning to lift up the neck as if in pride. And James is engaging in a little irony here, saying that the tongue is such a small... In the two illustrations before, James talked about how much the tongue can influence things. And here James is looking at the other side of the coin and saying that the tongue can boast about such great things and make such great promises, but yet those promises can fall through and amount to nothing. So we go from two illustrations that have no value judgments associated with them to the final illustrations that certainly have a value judgment. While the illustration of the horse and the bridle of the ship weren't trying to say the tongue was good or evil, we're going to end this section with how the tongue does have an intense power to destroy. The second half of James 3:5 says, behold, how a matter, or better translated, how great a forest a little fire kindleth. You can see that alternate translation in your margin. If not, you may want to pencil that in. Here the tongue is compared to a spark, and the ability of a single spark to burn down a great forest. And even in the fastest growing forests, like many of the fast forests that we have out in Virginia, it takes about 30 years to get a decent forest from a little seedling to a good grove of pines that you can harvest for lumber. It doesn't happen overnight. When you start looking at some of the hardwood forests, it can take over 1,000 years to get to a really mature grove of wood. Yet a little spark dropped by a careless fool can destroy all of that labor and effort and growth in a matter of days, reducing it to just a shell of its former glory. In the next verse, James warns, the tongue is a fire. The same can happen with the tongue. The tongue and misplaced words can destroy years of labor and grow into and destroy years of growth in an unbelievably short amount of time. An ecclesia, for example, can take decades to grow into a mature, vibrant lampstand, yet it can be decimated in a moment through a few careless words. I like the words of Brother H.P. Mansfield here on his commentary on James. He said, the stupid, boastful, spiteful, thoughtless use of the tongue. An undisciplined tongue in ecclesial circles can become the source of such disruption and stain on the ecclesia by creating rumors that can tear down characters, destroy useful labors, and cause doubts and dismay throughout the entire body. The stupid and thoughtless use of the tongue can undermine the effective work of an ecclesia, disastrously dividing and weakening it. Friendships and relationships can likewise take years to build and grow. Yet foolish and careless words can betray trust and inflict deep wounds in an instant. As Proverbs chapter 16, verse 28 says, a perverse person stirs up conflict. A gossip separates the closest of friends. Among the strongest examples of scripture that we have of the destructive power of the tongue is found in the wilderness. Oh, looks like it already advanced to that. After witnessing the mighty arm of God and the deliverance from Egypt and the parting of the Red Sea, we see the tongue lead to doubt. And they said unto Moses, because there were no graves in Egypt, hast thou taken us away to die in the wilderness? Wherefore hast thou dealt with us thus, to carry us forth out of Egypt? The tongue has complained at the waters of Meribah. They cried forth for bread and meat. The tongues drove Moses to smite the rocks in Rephidim. It incited the Lord to send fire among the congregation, Numbers 11. The tongues of Korah, Dathan, and Abiram instigated a rebellion of the people in Numbers chapter 16. The tongues of the people brought on the plague of fiery serpents in Numbers 21. And the tongues of a few led the congregation to reject the promised land in Numbers chapter 14. Notice the language that's used at the end of verse 6 in James 3. He describes the tongue as a fire, being set afire of hell. In your margin, it might show that the word hell in verse 6 is the Greek word Gehenna, that famous valley outside of Jerusalem where the citizens of Jerusalem would bring their refuse to be incinerated. The fires of Gehenna found their fuel in the filth of human waste. And so the destructive fire of the tongue is fueled by the filth of our flesh. When James described the tongue as a fire, he is trying to paint an image that teaches a lesson. It's like through life, it's almost as if through life we are walking through a dry forest with a lit match in our hand. And just think of how careful you would have to be if you're walking through that forest with that lit match, not to stumble and let it drop and let things go ablaze. That's the same level of care and caution James is telling you we need to apply to the things that we say. There's a second and more subtle example of the tongue's power to destroy, and we're going to see it in the next couple of verses. So the tongue's power to destroy in the terms of the fire, it's blatant and obvious. The tongue's power to destroy in the example of the serpent is much more subtle. In verse 7 and 8, he again shows the irony. He again engages in some irony. We can tame nearly any animal on earth, great and docile, ferocious and pleasant and poisonous, yet we can't tame the venomous tongue. And it's amazingly ironic how such a little muscle in our body can be so hard to control. In Genesis, man was given dominion over every creature, and yet we can't control such a small part of our body. James is trying to show that the way our tongue works makes no sense. Why would we ever say hurtful, mean, and unkind words to those we love the most, our friends, our family, children, or parents? Why would we ever speak in a hurtful way to our spouse, the one to whom the Lord gave us to help us to the kingdom? Husbands, we're supposed to be Christ to our wives. Would Christ ever use his tongue to hurt her? Absolutely never. And wives, you're supposed to be the loving helpmeet, the ecclesia to your husband. Would the ecclesia ever lash out at Christ in word? It should never be so. Then why do we do it? Why do we say unkind, unhurtful, destructive, insensitive, and brash things against our brethren for whom the Lord died? We've all had those moments where we're asking these questions, where we see the ashes of a relationship around us, and we ask ourselves, why did that start? Why did I say that thing? Or what was I thinking? Where did that come from? Even James had those moments as well. Because note, he still is using the word we throughout all of these passages. And the comparison of the tongue here to a poisonous animal is really interesting, and it rings quite true. Unlike an animal that kills prey outright, or fire that obviously rages through the forest and you can see the smoke from miles away, a poisonous animal kills subtly and from the inside. Some of the most destructive words we can say are those subtle jabs and hurts that we can pass along, those subtle idle words of gossip that can poison our view of others. The exhortation here is for us to be careful, not only in what we say, but also in what we hear. What poison do we allow into our own ears? We're told to esteem our brethren, to honor and love them. If we allow poisonous words of criticism and gossip to enter our ears about our brethren, it will jade our view of them, slowly but surely. We must all endeavor to apply those principles of Matthew chapter 18. If someone comes up to us wanting to talk about someone else, the first question must always be, have you talked with them first? Have you talked with them yet? And there's a real lesson here. Nothing we can do can be more damaging than saying the wrong things. Subtly, like the poisonous stink, or openly, like a raging forest fire, the tongue has a power to destroy. And having talked now about the, having talked about these items, James is going to move on to a different topic and talk about the tongue's power to delight. And that's the real pity of this as well. The tongue has such potential to do such good that it's a shame when we use it for evil. Moving on to verses 11 through 12, or sorry, 9 through 12. So through the next four verses, James shows us that the tongue is the primary example of the double-minded nature of man. The laws of nature show that we can't do two things at once. You can't both be fresh and salty at the same time. A fig tree won't produce olives, and a vine won't produce figs. Yet the tongue will do both. And here's the tragedy, that a stream of water and a bountiful tree can be things of such delight. The symbols of a fruit tree and a spring of water symbolize life, the word, the saints, salvation. It's interwoven with imagery of the kingdom. Likewise, the tongue can have such power to delight, praise God, and help our brethren. But so often it does the opposite. You can look in your handouts that the Bible describes both a tongue of life and the tongue of death. The tongue of the tongue can be something that brings death. It can be a cutting razor, a piercing arrow, a poisonous serpent. Scriptures say that the tongue can do great evil, can bring forth pride, backbiting, and lies. But on the other hand, as we're reminded in Proverbs chapter 18, verse 21, death and life are in the power of the tongue. The tongue can be kept from keep others from evil. It can speak what is right. It can praise the Father, be a nourishing tree of life, and preach the word. And as a little example of it, our youngest daughter, or our youngest, our only daughter, our youngest child, Mary, was able to join us for this weekend, but we had to leave our two oldest back at home, Noah and Elijah. And Noah is a great example of how the tongue can both just like transform in an instant from proclaiming happiness to sadness and despair. And so I share with you a little video of Noah at his first ecclesial business meeting. Okay, so you get the idea. He's sitting there in his little table at the end of the rows of tables for the business meeting. He's in his tongue from that one mouth is springing both words of happiness. He's delighted about his hands, and yet then he's completely tormented by the fact that he can't reach the camera. So from one mouth, you have two tongues springing forth. So what's the answer to all this? It might seem from the verses we've read so far that James is only emphasizing the negative, that we've got this great responsibility to use our tongues in the right way, but it's really, really hard, and no man can tame it. Well, James has been including throughout his epistles a bunch of teachings already on how we can control our tongues and use it for life and not death. So let's move on to James chapter 3 and verse 13. And talk about the words of the wise. Back in verse 8, we remember that the tongue no man can tame, but there is a solution. You notice that in that word, in the margin for James chapter 3 and verse 8, that the word man renders it nature of man. James isn't saying that our tongues are impossible to tame, because we know the Lord Jesus Christ was able to tame his tongue. It's just that our nature cannot control the tongue, and the natural man has no hope of taming it. But while there's no hope for the natural man to tame the tongue in James 3, verse 8, the wise man can. In fact, the wise man in James chapter 3, verse 13, is characterized by his ability to control what he says. Chapter 3 and verse 13, "Who is the wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom." And that's an emphasis phrase there, the meekness of wisdom. The first introduction James gives us for taming our tongue is to show us this idea of the meekness of wisdom. And that word meekness doesn't mean mild-mannered or timid, but it has connotations of someone who has the ability to exert themselves but chooses not to. Meekness is controlled strength. Jesus was meek not because he was weak, but because he had the power of God at his disposal, yet he never used it in a way that was improper. He never used it to assert his own self-interest. Moses was described as the meekest man on earth in Numbers chapter 12, verse 3. But that was in the context of him choosing to not lash out against the accusations of Miriam and Aaron. He was meek in that he controlled his tongue and controlled his strength. The first step to controlling our tongue is found in this: getting quiet. And James gives us two very practical instructions about this, in being swift to hear and slow to speak. It takes strength to be meek. Moses, the meekest man on earth, was seen in his ability not to lash out. Jesus opened not his mouth. It takes meekness to control our tongue. And I'll again turn to our two little boys, Noah and Elijah, for an illustration of some of this. All right, so James 1:19, "Let every man be slow to speak."
Elijah, can you show me how you listen? Is that how you listen? Show me listening. Yeah.
I shot the boy my bomb.
All right, not really sure what Noah said there at the end, but the point of that was James gives us some instructions on how to control our tongue. The first one is, let every man be swift to hear and slow to speak. And Elijah picked up this little trait of when we ask him to listen to something, he puts his hands over his mouth. And that's a really good action. He reminds himself, if he's going to hear, he can't be speaking at the same time if he's going to be listening to mommy or daddy. So that's what he was doing there. Hands over the mouth is how he listens. So in James chapter 1, verse 19, we read that first clue of controlling the tongue. Let every man be swift to hear, slow to speak. He pulls on a wealth of proverbial wisdom here that instructs us to be patient and judicious with our words. Like Proverbs that says in chapter 18, verse 13, "He that answereth a matter before he hears it, it is his folly and his shame." And I think we can all agree that most, if not all, of controversy around words comes from misunderstandings and miscommunications in talking before we really listen. If we could only take time to listen first, be slow to speak, ask questions first rather than stating answers, so much strife could be avoided. This requires us to become experts in the fine art of listening. Proverbs chapter 11, verse 12 reminds us that a man of understanding holds his peace. Proverbs chapter 17, verse 28, "And even a fool, when he holds his peace, is counted wise. He that shutteth his lips is a man of understanding." And appropriately, James gives himself, James himself gives us one of the finest examples of this own situation. We're not going to turn there now for sake of time, but if you look at Acts chapter 15, James showed the meekness of wisdom. He showed an example of being swift to hear and slow to speak at the Jerusalem Council. In James' example, he sits quietly through the entirety of the controversy at the council while others stood up and speak and couldn't resolve the issue. And at the very end, after he had listened and heard it all, he spoke. And those few well-informed words was able to bring resolution where many words was not. James, Acts chapter 15 and verse 13, "After they had held their peace, James spoke." James practiced what he preached. He was quick to listen and slow to speak. And when he did speak, he spoke with wisdom. Restrain your tongue is the other clue that James gives us on how we can tame our tongues. Again, back in James chapter 1, we have this principle in 1 verse 26, "If any man among you seems to be religious and bridleth not his tongue, but deceiveth his own heart, this man's religion is in vain." So even after we take the time to listen before we speak, we still need to have that bridle on our tongue. We need to rein it in and control what it says. It's a teaching that James directly lifts from David. In Psalm 39 and verse 1, we see, I said, I will take heed to my ways, I will not sin with my tongue, and I will keep my mouth with a bridle while the wicked is before me. And we have some practical instructions on how to do this as well. Over in Psalms 141 and verse 3, we read the plea to set a watch before my mouth, O Lord, keep the door of my lips. A watch is something that's laid out and set ahead of time. You send a watchman out to guard a city before the enemy troops arrive. And thus David was praying for God to help him identify those areas in which he needed to prepare ahead of time to control his tongue. It starts with identifying the places for potential failure. And this can be an excellent exercise for the memorial service. We're going to gather together tomorrow to remember Jesus with the bread and the wine. And it's helpful to take a moment in that context to think about those areas where we stumble with our speech and where we might need to be extra careful. Areas that we need to have a watchman set up over our own lips so that we can spot trouble a mile away and guard the things that we say. Do our tongues run out of control when we're running late? Or when we're tired and overworked? Or when we're with a certain individual or in a certain situation? If we identify that trouble spot ahead of time, pray about it and try to prepare for it and be as hypersensitive as a watchman would, keeping an eye out for trouble coming, we too can help control our tongues. We want to be able to say those words of Psalm chapter 17, verse 3. Thou hast proved my heart, thou hast visited me in the night. Thou hast tried me and found nothing. I shall purpose that my mouth shall not transgress. So ending out James chapter 3 in the test of the tongue, we see in verses 14 and 16 a contrast between two types of wisdom, that so-called wisdom of the world and the wisdom from above. You'll find both of these lists in your handout as well. You'll see that James mentions the qualities of these two types of wisdom in contrast to each other. Just like there are two types of tongues, one leading to life and one to death, there are two types of wisdom. And these last two verses of the chapter are a summary of what should be on our tongue. It's almost a checklist of sort that closes out James chapter 3. Our speech should be true. It should promote peace rather than stir up strife. It should be gentle and sensitive, easy to be entreated or reasonable, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality, where we are careful and loving in our speech. And speaking of how to use the tongue right, if you look through the course of the whole book of James, there are over 20 different specific instructions, and you'll also find this in your handout as well, of where James shows us how we should use our tongues, in addition to warnings against using our tongues. You'll also find that on the last couple pages of your handout. So in conclusion, James chapter 3, verse 8, said, no man can tame the tongue. It is a restless evil full of deadly poison. Brothers and sisters and friends, we cannot tame our tongues without God's help and without surrendering our tongue to God. We have seen in James that he is full of practical advice and wisdom about how we can make our speech obedient to the Father, but he also leaves no doubt as to how destructive it can be if we fail to control it. The tongue is powerful. It will direct our lives to good or evil. The tongue is destructive if we don't tame it. Yet it also has incredible power to delight. We've seen in this test our faith tested by our words. So before we speak, let's use the wisdom from above to test every word, to say, is it pure and true? Does it promote peace or stir up strife? Is what we are going to say gentle and full of mercy? Are we combining the words of truth and with equal measures of mercy as well? Would what we say promote unity or show partiality and create division? If we can answer those questions with yes, then we are showing that wisdom which is from above. God willing, tomorrow we'll look at the last two tests of faith in chapter 4 and chapter 5, faith tested through self-control and faith tested through patience.
Thank you, Brother Alan. So just one brief reminder before we close in prayer. The sign-up sheet for slides and recordings is over there on that table, so go ahead and write your name down, give us a yes or no as to what you'd like, if you'd like to get any copies of those. So in order to close our day, we will ask Brother John.